The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to History Island, celebrating the rich history of Long Island.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to History Island on 103.9 FM, LA News Radio, and I'm Dale Spencer, your host. And, of course, that was a song by the great Long Island band, you might call them, Foghat. Foghat was a bunch of English guys and a couple of Long Island guys that all got together, and they had a great, great band in the 70s, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, famous band. Most people might know the song Fool for the City, for example. Well, that was one of their early songs called Home in My Hand, and that was recorded down in Port Jeff on Long Island. And they used to do all their early recording down there. So I thought that maybe it would be a good idea to have a song by Foghat to start the show out tonight, because our show tonight is going to be a little trip down to Port Jeff Village and its history. Or as many people would say, I'm going down to Port. So anyway, I've got some great guests tonight. We're going to talk about Port Jeff and its history and some of the current events that are going on there. I'm sure a good amount of you have been down there and visited Port Jeff and seen the restaurants and the harbor, and it's just an unbelievable place. Its history is pretty amazing. It was originally, it was called Sawasset by the Native Americans who lived in the area, and that was a Native American term. It was either a place of small pines or where the open water is. And eventually, settlers started coming in, and they purchased a bunch of land from the Native Americans who were around there, and it eventually became a place called Drowned Meadow. I believe that was in 1836 when they changed that name. And so Drowned Meadow went on for a while. It became a giant. It went from a small farming community on the water, of course, like all Long Island's early communities. And it eventually became a major shipbuilding area. And at least 40% of the ships built on Long Island were built in Port Jeff in the wooden ship era back in those days. And, of course, the town has gone through many, many changes over the centuries, I should say, because it's been a long time people have been there. And so here we come up to today when people go there. I've got two really great guests for my show tonight. And one of them is the Port Jeff Village historian, and that's Chris Ryan. Hey, Chris, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing good.
And my other guest tonight is Laura Warren. And Laura is the curator of the Mather House Museum on Prospect Street in Port Jeff, a great place that you should go visit. So we're going to talk some Port Jeff tonight. So anyway, how are you two doing?
Very good.
Very well, thank you.
Good. And so how would you like to start out? Would you like to talk about a little of the history of Port Jeff, either one of you?
Sure. Well, we can start with the Native Americans, and then it became Drowned Meadow Bay. And we can get into it a little later, and then Mark Sternberg will be here, I think, later on.
Yes, he's going to be coming to talk about that.
Right, soon. And he's the expert on the Culper Spy, which is, you know, no one knew that Drowned Meadow was part of the Culper Spy ring until Mark's research. So I'm going to leave that to Mark.
Okay, good.
All right,
yeah,
so that's on. We're going to leave that section. And then in 1836, Drowned Meadow became Port Jefferson.
Right, and then it went on from there.
Right.
And I know that there was a lot of shipbuilding in the wooden ship era, and that all ended after basically steel ships started being built.
So, yeah, so roughly 1800, they started building some ships there. In the 1830s, it really started to pick up. And, you know, there were, you know, hundreds of large schooners and ships built in Port Jefferson Harbor at the time, during the 1800s. And it kind of ended around 1900.
Oh, yeah, right.
That was the last hurrah.
Yeah, and that started to be the era when basically Port Jeff became another port village in this area. And I know somewhere in the interim of that, the ferry service started.
Sure. 1883, I believe, is when the
right,
the
1883,
ferry started,
right.
Right, with the Nanawantuck. And of course, we've had ferries ever since then.
Yeah.
And a connection to Bridgeport, of course.
Yes. And I know that P.T. Barnum was actually a part of that history.
Right, yeah.
So a lot of people get on the ferry and they take the P.T. Barnum, and they don't realize that he's one of the people who helped to organize the ferry service.
Correct.
In the very beginning.
Beginning, exactly, yeah.
He lived in Port Jefferson for a while. He wanted to bring the circus to winterize in Port Jefferson, but the locals didn't want a bunch of elephants in the town. And that's why he went over to Bridgeport, because they were happy to have him. But he was still in Port Jeff, so he was one of the organizers of the Port Jeff Ferry. So
and it made a lot of sense, yeah, because he could go to the new home of the circus, which I believe the circus forever was over in Bridgeport somewhere,
yes,
there, right?
Yes.
After it moved. Yeah, and some people have told me, I don't know if I have this right, that the Beltaire area was where he was trying to organize the circus to have their home, that the yard was going to be somewhere up there. Mm. I don't know if I have that history right.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Yeah.
But someone has told me that.
Yeah.
So the village goes along, and of course, like all villages on Long Island, the growth just kept happening through the whole 1900s.
Sure.
And being a port, you know, it's...
Right. Well, I wanted to add that, you know, we had a little lull around 1900, and then World War I started, and that's when the government bought up all the old shipyards there and began to build steel ships for the war effort. So these weren't battleships, but they were military targets, ocean-going tugboats, freighters, tankers, and barges. For the First World War.
Oh, and that's a piece of the history that not many people really hear about.
Right, and then the building that you know, the Village Center, is one of those buildings. It's a World War I building.
Yeah, which is
a shipyard. Yeah,
just a tremendous building. Everyone, if you ever want to do a great visit up to Port Jeff, one of the places that you certainly should see is the Village Center. That great old factory has been turned into this wonderful three-story building, and they do programs. The archive is up there. They do different programs. They do all kinds of events, and of course, they have the outdoor skating rink every winter, all around Christmas time, and lots of people go up there and they skate. An amazing resource, always free to walk in. And it does some really great programs.
You know, some people would remember what an eyesore that building was for many, many years. It was. Do you remember that?
I do.
It was gray. It was rusted. And it was an industrial wasteland there. There was, you know, oil tanks and oil spills and gravel companies. And it was a mess. And it was a big project to make that into a park. And...
And it's so beautiful and picturesque to go to now. It's an amazing place.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're coming up on our first break, so we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back, and we got a lot more to talk about. You are listening to History Island on 103.9 FM, LI News Radio, and I'm, of course, Dale Spencer, your history guy. So come on back after the commercial. We'll see you in a minute. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Mike Cuevas.
And I'm Lisa Steffens, and we work at BLD's restaurant on Hawkins Avenue in Ronkonkoma. And we would love for everybody to come on down and visit us and check out our food items and our friendly atmosphere. We decorate all the time year round. And like I said, we are family owned. I'm there 20 years. Mike next to me is there about 15. And we would love everybody to come in and join us.
Yeah, you have to try our pancakes, our waffles, our French toast, even our ribs are good. Burgers are great as well. And don't forget, our police officers, our veterans, our fire department. We give discounts for veterans, police officers, 7 days a week.
So come on down and visit us. Our business hours are 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. And we're known for your home away from home.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. By the way, I hope everyone's having a great, great week. We got a couple of beautiful spring days and finally a little reprieve from some of the winter weather. So I hope you're all enjoying that. On some future shows, we're, of course, going to again start going out and telling people good places that they can go and enjoy themselves and go out and have a visit. And today is actually a really great part of that because we have some great Port Jefferson people here. Obviously, we have the village historian, Chris Ryan, talking about the Village Center and some things up there. And we also have Laura Warren, the curator of the Mather House Museum in Port Jeff. So anyway, before the break, we were talking, Chris, about the Village Center. And why don't we hear a little more about what's happened to develop that into what it's become?
Sure. Well, we talked before about what a rusting industrial hulk
it was
before and what it became, which is this wonderful place where all kinds of things can happen. So it's a multi-use building. And one little section of that is my office. And that office is very special because we can print very large photographs and do historic shows in a gallery, which is right outside of my door.
Right. The building is just a beautiful gallery itself. Mm-hmm. They had some amazing photographic displays there.
Right. Yeah. We have we do two historic shows every year, January, February, and September, October. So those are kind of my 4 months that I'm allowed to display historic pictures. And we have tens of thousands of historic images. Mm. Because my predecessor, Ken Brady, who unfortunately passed away in late October of last year, kind of started this whole thing. And when he started, it was very, very early in digitization.
Yes.
Okay, and now that is going to bring what you're going to tell me about, which is that he reached out to a lot of historical societies and offered to digitize their collections.
Yeah, he sure did.
Yeah.
We couldn't really do a show about Port Jeff without mentioning Ken. Ken passed away this year, and we all miss him so much. But what Ken did in the early days of he got the equipment to do the great digital work up there and to make great, great copies of the pictures and large copies. And I know when I first met him, one of the first things that he did is he went all over the village and he got stores and restaurants and places within the village to put up great historic pictures of the town. So you can still see some of that to this day. You go around the village and you walk in a store and there's a picture of the same area back in the 1800s or the early 1900s.
And we still do that. We still have, a business come to us and say, hey, we want Port Jeff historic pictures, and we can print them for them.
And so Ken basically was the beginning of setting up this amazing thing. He got a real large bed scanner, and he could make amazing copies. And also, by the way, I should mention, just a little off the side, that if you're in the Village Center and you go over by the archives, there's always a nice little section outside that has some poster board pictures for sale of different historic areas of Port Jefferson. And they're pretty affordable.
Well, they're $10 a piece because basically, once we put them on foam board, we can't store them anymore.
Right.
So our system, it's called like a Walker system, is, we'll produce this, 24 by 36, or we can make them 44 inches wide. And it has bar clips on the top and a bar clips on the bottom. And then we take the show down, we have our photographs, so they all go into a map drawer, and the map drawer is only about inch and a half, two, and we can fit several shows in a single in a single drawer unless we put it on foam board, and then we have to get rid of it because we just can't. You know, the foam board takes up too much room.
Yeah.
So that's why they're $10 a piece outside of my office there. Those are kind of our rejects from the shows. Yeah.
Right. So those of you who love the history, and of course, many of you listening tonight are our big history buffs of Long Island, go up there and check out some of the pictures, because that's a great little thing without even getting involved with anything else, that you can bring home a really nice picture, and you might look out and find the one that really strikes you.
Or we can print it for you. So we're very reasonable. Right. We have a huge collection, and we print. But I wanted to get back to what Ken did, where he reached out to all these organizations and said, hey, I'll digitize your collection.
Mm-hmm. He did it for us. And
which was?
The Lake Grand Concomitant Historical Society.
Right.
I was running the museum at the time. And what we wanted to do was we wanted to get our stuff digitized. But Ken came up with the idea, and he not only digitized everything for us, but he set us up with a great big historical exhibition about Lake Grand Concomitant history.
Sure.
And a lot of people might remember that one from, I believe it was 2012 when we had that exhibit.
Yeah.
He brought us a long way, because he made all those great copies for us, and that allowed us to go display them at other places and improve our museum exponentially. It just became so much better.
Right.
And Ken did this all over Long Island, and he reached out to everybody.
Right.
He was kind of the guy, I don't know what you could call him. He was the unstoppable force, Ken. He could tell you great stories. He could talk. He was an amazing guy. And we are very, very lucky, because once Ken left, and now Ken, of course, passed away, we have been really lucky to have Chris step into that role.
Yeah, I stepped in 2015 when Ken resigned, and we've just been continuing his legacy. You know, all these historical societies' pictures now, you know, they got them digitized, but we have copies of them in my office. So, for instance, we have all the Lake Ronkonkoma stuff and that Patchogue stuff, and it just goes on and on. And then I started reaching out to other organizations besides historical societies, namely when we did the Grumman exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
And that was just huge. We had, you know, I had no idea what was going to happen with that. But people just came out of the woodwork, all these old engineers who love Grumman, and with all their pictures. And we just got thousands of images digitized for that exhibit. And now we have a huge Grumman collection.
Oh. And there's a lot of people out there who are always looking for their old Grumman history.
Right. In fact, the whole show was so popular that it went down to Pax River in Maryland. We packed it up, and they took it down there. There's a naval base, or Air Force Base, Naval Air Base down there. And to their museum, and then it came back, and it was taking up so much room in the office that we gave it to the Suffolk Museum. So,
they're gonna
set up the Grumman exhibit, because they're, you know, close to Calverton there too,
and they have a lot of room to do great exhibits over there. Great place,
right?
Yeah, so that's really amazing. And by the way, people, if you ever want to meet a couple of Grumman people, go to the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Garden City and wander around and go into the room where the lunar lander that I believe was for Apollo 17 is.
Yeah.
And that is staffed by some ex-Grumman guys who sit in there, and they'll talk to you and tell you about what it was like to build that and what the projects were like. These guys... it's in their heart and soul. You can see they love their job. Of course, all of us grew up with Grumman as a big part of our lives here on Long Island.
Yeah.
You know, every town.
They loved working for Grumman.
Yeah. Yeah.
They did.
I agree.
Yeah.
Everybody loved working for Grumman. And, of course, one of the sad things that we lost Grumman here, because it was one of those businesses that really was the backbone of the economy of Long Island for decades. And once we lost them, we lost something that we're not ever going to get back here business-wise. Never mind the heart and soul these people put into it. And when you look at a film of the guys in Apollo 11, landing on the moon, you can think of the Grumman guys who built that and put everything into it and made it so those guys could get up there and back safely. You know, pretty amazing history.
Yeah, it was incredible. And we did a Long Island Railroad exhibit, and then all these railroad people came in with their pictures. So we have a huge railroad collection now.
Oh,
Long Island Railroad collection.
Right.
And then we did an auto racing exhibit, and all these people came in with auto racing pictures, and now we have a big auto. Yeah, so it just it's a system. We digitize for them, and they get the digitized, and sometimes we just give them the prints if they're extras, and it's a win-win situation for everybody.
That's right. That's a real win-win for everyone. And, of course, for those who don't know it, auto racing, one of the early auto racing capitals of the world, in a way, because auto racing came over here very early in 1904 when Willie K. Vanderbilt started the Vanderbilt Cup races while he was building the Motor Parkway. He wanted to raise money for the Motor Parkway, and he brought the international road races over for the first time in Long Island history and had the Vanderbilt Cup races, which lasted a good decade on Long Island. So, and racing has gone on and on forever there,
yeah,
because of that. A lot of people don't know, if you happen to be old enough to remember the old Roosevelt Raceway, well, that was actually opened as a car racing track. And for the first 2 years of its history, it did auto racing. And then it became a horse racing track.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, and most people don't really know that. But auto racing, always one of the backbones of Long Island. I grew up as a little kid going to Islip Speedway, and I'd go
with
there.
Oh, the figure eight?
Yeah, the figure eight. And every Sunday, the drag races, they had an eighth of a mile drag strip. And they had cars on Sunday, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday was racing day in my community in Long Island.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty amazing thing.
And we had two cars built in Port Jeff, and the hill race that Chris
right,
has.
We haven't even talked about the hill climb yet.
The hill climb.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Let's talk about that when we come back from the break. So here we go. You're listening to History Hour, 103.9 FM, LI News Radio. And I'm Dale Spencer, your host. We'll see you, and we'll talk more about that when we come back. Everybody, welcome back to History Island. I'm Dale Spencer, your host, and you're, of course, listening to us on 103.9 FM, LI News Radio. Yeah, that's right, 103.9. So anyway, if you're traveling around, you need a limousine. Call my friends over at Long Island Elite Limo. They're at 768 Middle Country Road in St. James. And they are one of the best, most reliable limo companies on Long Island. Have all kinds of vehicles. Can do everything from an airport trip to a wedding to funerals to winery trips to whatever kind of idea you might need. They're really good with tailgate parties for ball games and concerts. Long Island Elite Limo, call them up at 631-331-5466. Now, when I'm out in the morning, I'm in the Neskonset area, and I'm traveling around. If I want to get a good breakfast sandwich, or I want to get some groceries, things like that, I always stop at the Handy Pantry on Neskonset Boulevard in Neskonset. Great little place. It's like a little mini supermarket. And I always go there. So what you should do is go in, see Kevin or his crew over there, and they'll take good care of you, and they will give you one of the best breakfasts you ever could want to have. So a nice little place, a community store. So anyway, we're talking to Chris Ryan, the Port Jefferson Village historian, and Laura Warren, the curator of the Mather House Museum. So anyway, before the break, Chris, we were talking a little bit about Grumman.
Yes.
And the Grumman plane, I believe, is something you wanted to talk about, right?
The Grumman.
The lost plane.
Oh, the plane, yes. Yeah. Well, I think we're gonna say most of it for the segment, but yes, there was a jet in 1951. Bruce Tuttle, a test pilot for Grumman, was up above 30,000 feet above Long Island doing his testing, and he flamed out. And he tried to restart. This is in the wintertime, I believe. I think it was in December. And he had to ditch. He dropped below the clouds, and he saw a little hole in the clouds and dropped below and ditched his jet, his Panther jet, 1951, state-of-the-art at the time. Okay, this is the Cold War. And he ditched it in Long Island Sound, right outside of Port Jefferson Harbor.
Wow. Where it sits today, apparently.
And we cannot find the jet.
Wow. Now, I'm sure not too many Long Islands is a part of that.
And so it could have gotten covered up with sand.
Yeah.
We don't think it's disintegrated. So the story goes, the salvage guys found it. It slid down an embankment 80 feet, and then they couldn't find it.
Wow.
Now, there is a shoal, Mount Misery Shoal, right outside the harbor with a slope just like that. So, but it could have been covered up just like a sand dune, you know, covering something up. That's very possible.
Oh, right, because if it slides down in the sand.
Another possibility is the Russians were there with their subs, you know. They're watching. Oh. They're listening. You know, they're listening to the radio transmissions. They're outside of electric boat listening for the subs coming out of there. They're right in the area. And that's a possibility also. But we know that it didn't disintegrate completely because there's a Grumman Guardian, a similar size plane, which ditched outside of Baiting Hollow. That's a known wreck. And we've seen pictures of divers on that thing. It's only, I think, 3 years earlier, or 3 years later, I should say, 1954 or 53, and it's in similar conditions in 60 feet of water. And that's a deck, a wreck that divers, you know, can tell, you know, the instrument panels and stuff like that are still there.
Sure, it gives us a good idea what condition that might be in. Sure, so that's kind of right. Mm-hmm. It would be a big story if that ever gets found.
Well, yeah, I think we got some people that I think you'd like to talk to and about that, because we've already done a podcast with somebody else on it. It's a very interesting story, but we haven't found it, and I would just love to find that jet.
Well, that's an amazing story. When you find it, you're going to have to come back on and talk about it.
We've had guys, you know, with the side scan radar, sonar, I should say, out there, and nothing. No.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
I don't want to talk too much about that, because that's definitely that's a whole nother story.
Oh, we could go on and on about that story.
Yes, yes.
So anyway, let's get back to some village history. And Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Mather House Museum?
Okay. After World War II, the local residents wanted to create a memorial to all those men and women who served and died in the war. And they had a big fundraiser. They had school children coming, collecting pennies to bring it in. They'd made a lot of money. They decided that it would be nice to purchase a house in Port Jefferson and have it open for all the different organizations in town. The Boy Scouts would meet there. The Garden Club would meet there. And then in 1969, the local residents created the Historical Society. And we were in the house and actually took it over then because we started collecting artifacts. And it's become an artifact museum as opposed to a digital photo museum. We have 7 buildings. We have the house is John T. Mather's home, who was a shipbuilder, had one of the largest shipyards, and the Mather family had them in the village. His house was kind of up on a hill where he could overlook what was going down on in the shipyard. We've restored the for tours the inside as it would have been when he lived there. In 1974, we got a small house that was down near Main Street and moved it through town. They gave us the house if we would take it off the property because the owners wanted to build something else. And that was fun. It came up on through the town on a wagon. They had people on the roof lifting the power lines as the house went through town. And then we restored it for the bicentennial. We also have a marine barn. We have a country store, a tool shed, a carriage shed, post office, a barber shop, a butcher shop, a sail loft. In 2000, we had a local couple that had a huge clock collection. They had over 1,000 clocks in their house. And they tried to donate it to the village, but the village said, what are we going to do with that? So they donated them to the Historical Society, we said we had no place to put it, but an anonymous friend gave us money to house over 200 of the clocks. And it's one of the, it's the only clock museum in the local area. There is, nearest one is way up in upstate New York or in Massachusetts, and it's quite a find. And then we decided we had a lot of, in an old house, you really can't keep track of everything or keep it preserved, so we built an archive building with the help of funds from Steve Englebright.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of the original photos that Chris nicely copies, then we have a huge photo collection of the original photos, because researchers really want to see the original photos that have not been retouched or enhanced.
Oh, yes.
And yeah. So it's very important to keep those original photos. So we have a state-of-the-art archive building. And then it's also all the documents, and we have boxes and boxes and boxes of documents, which eventually Chris is going to help us digitize sometime when he has free time. but we are open for tours. We open in May and run through October. We're open 5 days a week, and you can tour all these wonderful buildings. We have an exhibit every year that we change, and this year it's before the internet, and it's how you communicated before you just looked at your phone. And
You mean there was a time before the internet?
There was.
That's what I heard, yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah, us old school people all know about that. Sorry, kids. Yes, there really was a time when you didn't have the phone in your hand.
And it's fun to go through and see people going, oh, my gosh, I remember that. And it's a wonderful exhibit.
So now you open in May, right?
Yes.
And so 5 days a week you're open?
Yes, Wednesdays to Sundays from 12 to 4. Donation requested, and we have guided tours, and we also have created walking tours of the village. You can get copies of that at the museum or at the library. I don't know if you have it down at the community center, but the chamber has them, of all the houses and the local stores that are around in the area.
Oh, that's great. Is there a phone number people can call to get in touch with you?
Yes, 631-473-2665, and our website is www.portjeffhistorical.org. All that information is on that.
Oh, excellent. And me and my wife do a lot of visits up to Port, and we haven't actually done that part yet. So we're going to do that this summer. We'll definitely see you at some point soon.
I highly recommend it, and there's plenty for kids to see. All ages love it. You don't have to be a history lover to enjoy it, just to take a step back in time.
Well, that's true, and that was evidenced by the Dickens Festival for all that time, when you didn't have to know anything about history to go and go walk through an 1800s village and have some roasted chestnuts and the parade and all the things went on forever over there. It was a really great festival. But that's Port Jeff. Everyone over there, me and my wife spent a little time over there this week shopping and going around and looking in a few stores. And it's another village, like all the ones we've been going to, that have that little village feel. And everybody knows each other. And people all connect up, and they all really love the town, and they love the history, and they have a passion for it. So it's one of the first places I'm going to talk about this year that I would like everybody to get up there on a time when you have a beautiful day off and enjoy Port Jeff. So that's great. And you got any kind of other special events going on this summer beside all those things?
Yes, in 2 weeks. The Historical Society's major fundraiser is an Antiques and Gardens Week at the Village Center. It's April 27th to 28th. There's antiques and garden plants and everything. It's three floors. I think it's 10 to 5, right?
Oh, okay. 10 to 5. And what's that date again for anyone who might not have caught it?
April 27th and 28th.
Okay, good. And they can they get more information. They could call, I think, the Village Center or the museum, right?
Correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to add, at the same time, the 27th and 28th, the Drowned Meadow Cottage Museum will be open.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so that's the Culper Spy Museum, which we haven't talked about too much. But, you know, that's for Mark when he comes in here. But, you know, Mark's done a lot of new research on Culper Spy. So it's a little museum, but it packs, punches well above its weight. It's full of information. We have the Culper Spy stuff, the Roe family we talk about. We have a flax exhibit. We have some stuff for the kids also. And we usually have spinners or weavers there also at the same time. So you can see both of those at the same time. You go to the garden show, and then you can come over to the museum.
Okay, well, there you go, everybody. And people who like to study a little bit about the Culper Spy Ring, when Mark comes on, he's doing some heavy-duty research, and new knowledge is coming all the time out about that. And, of course, that's how it is with great history. You always, if you get someone who's passionate about studying it, you find out more. And he's going to have a lot to say on the show. These two people that I have sitting right here with me today, you have to just congratulate them, because they're carrying on the tradition of keeping Port Jeff's history alive and moving forward. And that's a wonderful thing. Any other events at the Village Center you want to talk about, or the museum?
The museum had letters, Civil War letters, from two local young men who were actually from Cold Spring Harbor at the time, ran off to war, wrote letters home. One of them did not return. We published a book of their letters. We transcribed and published them. And then we made a video of it. And that's going to be shown again in Huntington, the Huntington Historical Society, because the kids were from Cold Spring Harbor, and that'll be on May 9th at the Art Museum.
Oh.
I mean, at the Art Cinemas.
Oh, they are in Huntington, right?
In Huntington, so you could call there. We will be there with the books if you want to polish and to just, if you want to purchase one, and just to talk about the letters.
Oh,
but
okay.
It's the way on Long Island we all work together, as we've been talking, that all the historical societies come together to share the history, because it's all Long Island history. It's not just Port Jeff history.
That's right. And of course, the reason we call our show History Island, because that's the place we live. And the historical community has always been great here, and everybody does work together, and there's always been a lot of cooperation. And that's great to hear that you guys are doing that particular program. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, so anything else you guys got on the horizon?
Yeah, I have. We have our annual hill climb, because they used to race up the hill. Mm-hmm. This is the East Hill in Port Jefferson with cars back in the early 1900s. So we recreate that. So August 17th is the hill climb. So it's a ceremonial thing where we have classic cars being announced and going up the hill one at a time. And it's a great event. We used to do it every 5 years. And now we're doing it every year because, people were telling me that they were just too old, to wait another 5 years. A lot of the guys are older, so, so we do it every year now. And we do a little exhibit on the hill climb. And the other thing that I got to mention is that we're building Caleb Brewster's whaleboat.
Oh, right. A big project.
Myself, but the Bayless Boat Shop, which is right in back of the Village Center, right on the other side of the ice skating rink, if you know where that is, on Tuesday mornings, Thursday, and Saturday mornings from 9 to 12, we are recreating Caleb Brewster's armed whaleboat. And we say armed whaleboat because we were confusing people by saying whaleboat. And they thought, of course, that we were going to kill whales, or they were used to kill whales.
Oh, right.
And then once we told people they were only used to kill British loyalists, then people were a little more relieved after that.
A little happier about that.
Yes. So this is a 25-foot boat with oars, and this is a This is a copy of it. This was drawn up by a naval architect during the bicentennial. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
1976. Yeah. Two of them were made, one in Darien, Connecticut, one in Huntington, and those are really not functional anymore. They need some work. So we're going to have ours probably ready by next year. It'll have a swivel cannon on the front and a small sail that can be put up, and we're hoping maybe to row it across the Sound, just like Caleb Brewster used to do.
That'd be a wonderful thing. Now, when you're doing the work over there, is that something that people could come and observe?
Yes, yeah. Nine to 12, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. Just walk in, and you can see the guys. So the frames are up, and they're getting ready to bend the cedar planks around the outside of the boat right now.
Now, do you have a lot of volunteers?
Tons.
So you don't really need volunteers for this effort? Or?
Well, no, I'm not in charge of LISIC, which is the boat building
thing,
but they have gotten so many people involved, and it's become this place where everybody wants to see this boat being built.
Wow.
And you know, when you have a great project like that, it brings a lot of interesting people together. So you know, people come in and they're like, oh, by the way, I've got a logbook from, this ship. Oh,
They walk in with it.
There's so many other things that have happened because it has attracted people, and interest. And all of a sudden these people say, well, you know, we've got this thing, you know, and it's just been amazing. You know, I got a logbook from a ship that went in 1849 from New York to San Francisco during the gold rush.
Wow.
You know, the 49ers. And she had it in her house. And I digitized it and gave it back to
her. That's amazing.
And now, you know, we can share it.
Yeah, that's really great. So everybody, you know, take the kids. Get down there. I think that's something where you can really show them something about the history of Long Island. To look at a picture of an ancient ship in a book is a lot different than to see one being built and worked on.
Yeah.
And it's a great place to go. So anyway, unfortunately, we've, of course, filled the whole show up, and we have a lot more we could talk about. But we're going to get both of you back, and we'll talk more about Port Jeff history, and that we're going to talk about this Culpa Spy Ring, and on we go. Meanwhile, April and May, get up there to Port Jeff. It's going to be a great summer up there.
27th and 28th is a good weekend that's coming up.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
That's when you can see the garden show, and we'll have the Culpa Spy Museum open those 2 days also.
Okay, there you go, everybody. We're going to see you up there at the Village Center and at the Mather House. Thank you, too, for coming so much. And you are listening to History Hour, 103.9 FM, LI News Radio. And I'm Dale Spencer, your host and your history guy.